One, two, yeah, okay. Dear friends, Your Excellency, the Ambassador, dear students, dear guests, welcome to this event. It is kind of becoming a traditional termly panel debate at the Hellenic Observatory, the Center for Research on Contemporary Greece and Cyprus. We're talking today about an issue which is important to Greece, but it's important on its own sake for everybody, but definitely in Europe. And our focus is perhaps European, perhaps more so than other events: the future of social protection in Europe, welfare state risks and policy responses for Europe and Greece. And we're very, very privileged to have with us three excellent speakers with a lot of expertise on the topic. I will take a minute to introduce them all, but let me start by a couple of housekeeping points. We will have the presentations by the speakers, and then we'll have a bit of a discussion. We'll open it up for our Q&A. For those of you using X, Twitter, the hashtag for today's event is #LSEGreece, one word. The event is being live streamed and recorded, so be mindful if you make any public statements that is being recorded. The recording will be available, subject to not having any technical problems, on YouTube and on our YouTube channel. And as I said, we'll have the time for a Q&A session towards the end of the event. When asking, indicate you have a question. If you're asked to ask a question, please ask a question and not do an oral essay on the topic of your choice, and identify yourselves. That's the rules of the game. We hope to have a fruitful and informative discussion. As I said, we have the speakers here to carry us forward on the topic. I will introduce them in the order that they will speak. So our first speaker will be Professor Sir Julien Legrand, who is Professor of Social Policy at LSE. And he's currently a member of LSE's Marshall Institute. Professor Legrand has a long, both academic and policy involvement on social policy issues, not only in the UK, where he served as a high-level, senior policy advisor to the Prime Minister back in the 2000s, but also working with international organizations such as the European Commission, World Bank, the OECD, and others. He received his knighthood in 2015 for his service to social science and public service, and he's written extensively on topics of social policy, education, public policy, economics, philosophy, with over 20 books, over 100 of academic articles, and so forth. He is really one of the principal architects of the UK's public service reforms in the turn of the century, and as we were talking also earlier, kind of one of the minds behind the idea of creating competition between services, between schools, between hospitals, in order to improve services and social service provision. Our second speaker is Ms. Anna Diamandopoulou, who is currently president of Dictio, the Network for Reform in Greece and Europe, an Athens-based think tank. But you will probably all know Ms. Diamandopoulou definitely from her service as Minister in Greece, Minister of Development in 2012, and before that, Minister of Education, with a known effort on education reform in 2009-2012. She is also a Council member of the European Council of Foreign Relations and member of the Scientific Council of the Foundation of European Progressive Studies. But more importantly for the topic of today, she served as chair of the European Commission's high-level group on the future of social protection and the welfare state in the EU, who published a report just now a couple of years ago, just over a year ago, I think. Last but not least, immediately to my left is Professor Panos Tsakloglu, a good colleague and a good friend, both personally and of the Hellenic Observatory. He's been visiting or associated with Hellenic Observatory for a number, very many years. He's currently member of the Monetary Policy Council of the Bank of Greece. But before that, he served as Deputy Minister of Labour in charge of social insurance between 2020 and 2025. And even before that, he was chairman of the Greek government's Council of Economic Advisors. He's also been a member of the EU Economic and Financial Committee and a number of other roles as senior policy advisor for previous prime ministers. I won't say everything, also not indicating how long back your career goes, Pano. And he has contributed in the academic debates, both in labor economics and social policy, topics on education, and so forth. So, as I said, our three speakers are very well placed to take us through the topic of today. I will now stay quiet and pass the floor and the clicker to Professor Legrand. Julian.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for that generous introduction. I'm not going to speak for very long. As you can see, we've got a tiny subject here to talk about. You may be a little surprised as to why capitalism is in there as well. And the reason will become clear in a moment. Basically, I was asked to discuss some of the principles of social protection in Europe. And I looked back at some of the historical reasons for the growth of welfare, the growth of the welfare state, the growth of social security. And basically, of course, the origins are probably close to the Euro protection since 1945, and built on the core belief that the state has a responsibility for ensuring that all its citizens attain a minimum level of well-being and security. Some of you will know about the Beveridge Report, which was published in Britain in 1942. He identified five giants: want, disease, ignorance, squalor, and idleness. And he proposed a whole set of measures that would actually try and deal with these various problems, these various the five giants, and to cut them down to size. And these are measures that in one way or another, most European countries have also implemented. Sometimes they'd implemented them well before the Beveridge Report, but nowadays virtually all European countries have policies in the areas of trying to reduce poverty and inequality, trying to reduce the amount of ill health and suffering, trying to reduce ignorance through education policies, squalor due to housing condition, poor housing conditions, and trying to reduce unemployment and the inability to find work. Of course, this wasn't the only principle that was often suggested by the analysts of the welfare state. Those of who perhaps follow Karl Polanyi said, actually, it's simply a device for bandaging up capitalism, for dealing with the problems of capitalism. If we put it slightly less provocatively, one could say, well, its aim is to secure legitimacy for the capitalist liberal democracies, and to make sure, and if there's regard to the legitimate, that will help promote social peace and harmony in those societies. So according to this argument, that essentially the future of social protection in Europe is very much dependent upon capitalism and upon what happens with capitalism as a determining factor to look at the future of social protection in Europe. And that's basically the kind of thesis that I want to develop in the few minutes I've got here. Now, you may now be a little surprised as to why, in talking about the future of social protection, indeed the future of capitalism, we are immediately starting with the past. And in particular, we're starting about the having a look at the pandemic in the 14th century Europe, the Black Death. Now, the Black Death led to a variety of major social and economic changes in Europe. And they're not too dissimilar in some respects from some of the problems that we are going to encounter in Europe in the future. The interesting thing about the Black Death was, well, there were many interesting things about the Black Death. The most appalling thing was its death toll. There are some estimates that it killed about half the population of Europe. I've looked at some of the estimates for Greece, and it seems to be between 25% and 40% of the population was killed by the Black Death. And although obviously an appalling tragedy, it had some curious beneficial effects, at least for the survivors, and particularly for those survivors who worked on the land. There was up to that point, there was basically throughout most of Europe, there was a feudal system, a system which basically landowners were the chief, held the power in the society. They held the economic power and they held the political power over society. The Black Death, by killing a large number of laborers, actually transformed that situation. Some people would argue that it led to the collapse of feudalism because there was now masses of land and far fewer people to work on that land. Wages shot up. They were shot up throughout Europe, including in the Eastern Mediterranean. And there was a very substantial shift of power, essentially, from the landowners to labor, from if we regard land as a form of capital, from capital to labor, which was virtually unprecedented. And it lasted for about 200 years, this difference. It was a massive impact, as indeed one might expect from a pandemic of such epidemic proportions. Are we facing anything like a Black Death pandemic now? Well, oddly enough, this is not to do with the COVID pandemic. I'm going to draw your attention to another problem that we are, and no doubt we'll discuss more as the evening progresses. But that's the aging of the population. There are many figures about this, which I won't go into, but the striking one is this particular figure, which is the dependency ratio. That's the number of workers per person retired for a variety of European countries. I don't know how visible that is, particularly from the back, but what it shows basically, if we look for various selected countries, France, Germany, Italy, the UK, and Greece, that the number of workers per person retired was round about four in the 1990s. By now, it has declined to three, round about three, round about two and a half for most countries. For Greece, it's declined to 1.7 to 1.8. By 2050, the projection suggests that for most countries, it will go down to two or below two. And for Greece particularly, it goes down to one. So you've got one worker per one per retiree in 2050. Well, what sort of implications does this have? The implications for capitalism are, in a sense, quite profound. There'll be a massive increase in inflation because you will have large numbers of people who are demanding to be fed, demanding to be housed, demanding to have their to be treated for their illnesses and so on. And you'll have very few people allowed to provide it. And that's likely to lead to a significant increase in prices. It will lead, just as the Black Death did, the death toll, Black, it will lead to mass increases in real wages, perhaps quite large. It's interesting, it'll probably lead to a fall in the returns to capital because basically you'll have a large amount of capital equipment or a capital that will have skilled workers to employ it. And also on a more sort of social level, most people think it will lead to a fall in technological and social innovation of various kinds as the population gets elderly. What about the implication of social protection? Well, in the sense they're obvious and have been much talked about, the increases in demand for pensions, healthcare, social care, sheltered housing to cope with people with disabilities due to age. It is worth noting that there will be some net gain in the sense, or there'll be a fall in demand for other areas like education, and a fall in demand for unemployment benefits, in-work welfare benefits, which many countries have, and in types of housing. There'll be a shift in really in demand for housing away from family housing towards shelter housing. And there will be some savings there, but I think most of the analysts, and we may talk about this later on, would think that the increase in demand will massively outweigh the financial savings from the fall in demand that occurs for education and so on. Can we do anything about this? Well, a variety of solutions have been suggested. There's various pro-natalist policies, including Greece, I understand. We may talk about those later on, such as cash handouts to families or associated with children. I've looked at quite a few of these in the various countries, and I think the general consensus is that they do a little to raise the fertility rate, but on the whole, but not very much and probably not enough. One exception here is I recently gave a talk in Ukraine about this kind of topic. They invited me to do it. I thought extraordinary thing to talk about in the context of Ukraine, but anyway, they invited me to do so. And they have one rather successful pro-natalist policy that's actually raising the population, raising the fertility rate. The rule in Ukraine for conscription is that fathers of families that are larger than three do not get conscripted. So I think it's a rather drastic way of raising the fertility rate. But apart from that, most of the policies don't seem to work very well. Raising the retirement age, of course, most European countries are trying to do this, and it turns out politically hard. I mean, France is the obvious example, but most countries have found it really quite tough. Some people argue, well, don't worry, AI is going to come to our list. Large language models, particularly large language models, are going to resolve the problem. We'll all have massive degree they will cause massive unemployment, and actually that will resolve the problem because there will be lots of labour that's relatively unemployed, and so we'll be able to use it, hopefully. I've looked at quite a lot of the research on this, and so far it has to be said it is much exaggerated. There seems to be very little impact in terms of impact on employment. Or whatever. The one exception, there's one article about the demand for translators. That appears to have dropped dramatically. But outside of that, there's very little studies from Oxford, recent Oxford Economics study, MIT, various studies, and they suggest that really this is a bubble and has been vastly over-exaggerated. Immigration, of course, is another answer for Europe. But of course, as we know, this is not politically popular, leads to a massive rise of populism parties promoting social division. It's a long way from, if you remember, the aim of the social protection was to promote peace and harmony. And this is obviously a long way from it. These are, of course, some of the populist parties that are rising. with Giorgio Meloni in Italy, Alice Weidel in Germany, and Marine Le Pen in France, and Nigel Farage in the UK. I understand that there's no real direct equivalent to this in the to these people in Greece at the moment, but they may well appear. No. So, where does that leave us? Well, the Black Death led to a shift in power from landowners to peasants with far-reaching consequences. In a similar fashion, will population aging shift power from capital to labour? So will the future of capitalism in Europe actually be labourism, with labour as the dominant, holding the reins of power? And will the future of social protection in Europe be less about protecting the owners of labour, as much of the original welfare state was designed to do, but more about protecting the elderly owners of capitalism? I put in, it is worth owners of capital. It is worth remembering that the by far the largest number of owners of capital are not the equivalent of Elon Musk's or Bill Gates or whatever. They are the pensioners who are being supported by pension funds throughout Europe in one form or another. And it may well be that those are the people who are going to need protection in the future, rather more than the providers of labour. Thank you.
Thank you, Julian. I think this idea of labourism is very thought-provoking, so we'll perhaps come back to that. We're a bit conscious about time, so we're moving directly to Anna Diamantopoulou.
Okay. Yes, thank you. Thank you very much for this invitation. I think it is the fourth time that I've been invited, and it's really an honor for me. First of all, I would like to introduce myself in a different way to make more understandable the presentation. As you see, I'm the only one who is not a professor. During my whole life, I don't know if it is by coincidence or I have chosen it without understanding it, I deal with social issues and welfare state. So I was commissioner for employment and social affairs, and then minister for education, and then I was chairing this group for the reform of the welfare state. And it is very difficult to speak about European welfare, as you can imagine, in 10 minutes. So welfare is educational system, it is health system, security, social security system, pensions, and social protection. So there are so many different policies. And I would like to focus on the social protection system. We live in a period that Europe is writing again its own history. And I think that among the transformation we're discussing, one of the most fundamental one is the future of the welfare state. And this is a European achievement. Can we speak about a European welfare state, a European system? No, we cannot. There are different systems. There are three models, the Anglo-Saxon one, the Central Europe, the Nordic one. But according to my experience, I worked even with Eastern countries when they entered the European Union, because at that time I was commissioner. Everywhere there was a welfare state, a different kind, but everywhere, in each country in Europe. So it is a European achievement. And in recent crises, in COVID, in energy crisis, in economic crisis, the welfare state has shown that it was the unsung hero. I mean, it was because of this welfare state that we have a protection in incomes, it stabilized the labor markets, and of course, it prevented large-scale social dislocation. After the COVID, we worked on this need of reform of the welfare state, and there is a need of reform, and the professor has already explained the big changes that we see in front of us. We worked on, in this group, we worked about 2 years. We have a consultation with all member states, and we had, first of all, identified four mega trends. The first one is demographic change. I'm not repeat what the professor has already said. It is the digital transformation. And here we have, we see day by day, the loss of jobs, the differences in jobs, the impact in the social security system, the impact in the labor, the work rights, the workers' rights. It is the changing world of war. Look, it is interesting that the recent, during the recent decades, we have, and particularly after the COVID, we have a higher employment rate, we have a higher insecurity, a higher inequality, and a higher number of non-standard contracts in all member states. And of course, it is the climate crisis and the green transition. And here, it is interesting again that the impact of both has, we have a bigger impact in the middle class people and in the weaker economic classes. So when there is a catastrophe because of climate crisis, who pay for that, particularly the middle class? And when we have this green transition, where is the impact to the young people, to the need of new job, of new kind of jobs, the green jobs, new companies, new investments, a new world, and we are not prepared for that. So it is obvious that we have entered an era that the crisis is not episodic, is not no longer episodic. Now it is, the crisis has become structural. So let me, these are the, yes, no, I cannot see. These are the four mega trends. And here I would like just to show you what is the Europe we're talking about. 24% of children are currently at the risk of poverty or social exclusion. In Europe, in one of the most rich places in the world. This means that nearly one in four children begins life with significant disadvantage. Second, at the same time, 11% of young people aged 15 to 29 are not in employment and education or in training. Here, I would like to underline something which was very shocking. We have a consultation with youth organizations across Europe, and believe you or not, the answer, what is the number one problem of young people, was the mental illness. So this is something very new and something that we are not prepared to deal with. Demographic projections, you can see, you, in Europe, we are going to have 130 million people in 2050. And of course, it has to do with the dependency ratio and social spending needs. And in the labor market, 40% of workers are now in non-standard contracts and in non-standard forms of employment. This was not the case in Europe 20 or 25 years ago. And we have to take into account when all this political turbulence and all these problems that parties, and particularly mainstream parties, have. Now, in this particular moment, what is the political discussion? What is the shift we need to have in the social protection systems? During the 20th century, we have a great success. And what we are proud of is that the achievement of the European Union in almost all member states was that the states guaranteed the economic security of old age and of disabled people, which was an extraordinary achievement. But now, in the 21st century, this is not enough. Now we have to invest in young generations. And the main problem is to give them the opportunity to have life fair opportunities, particularly in areas of labor, of education, of social mobility. And this is why the report presented a whole policy, an holistic policy, which was holistic because it is across the whole life, from the babies from zero, from age of zero to the 100 years old. Of course, the distribution policy remains very important. It is essential, but it is not enough. Now we have to move to what we call social investment, and this means human capital, education, and lifelong learning, care infrastructures, and capabilities. And we're talking about secure capabilities, which means that allow individuals to navigate continuously in a world which is changing. Here, again, I would like to underline something. We're talking about educational changes, about lifelong learning, about changes in the labor market. There is a need, and this is one of the most urgent, to my point of view, issues, to combine the Aristoteles approach, I mean, and by that I mean humanistic studies, with digital skills. We very much focus on digital skills, but this is not the way that we can occupy machines, to be very, very concrete. And I think it is something that we can discuss about. Now, to operationalize this shift, this political shift, we have, as I told you, to adopt a life course perspective. And this means three stages: early life and family formation, working life, and an old age. We have, there is, for those who are interesting to be in details, there is this report, and you can find it in as well in the internet. And there we have analyzed in with 21 recommendations. With 21 recommendations, we have been concrete how we believe that we can change step by step our policies, but in these three areas: the early life, working life, and old age. In these 21 recommendations, we tried to be to work quite a lot with details. For example, we start with children first. And children first means that the state has to invest from age 0 to 3. Until now, it was over 3. Now it is from 0 to 3. And this is what the Anglo-Saxons education and care. And according to all studies, we worked with OECD, with many universities, institutions, it is the number one issue. The second important issue, which has to do with the working life, it has to do with the need of social protection to all kind of forms of work, because we cannot continue, we can no longer go on with tied exclusively to standard employment. This is not the case anymore. And focusing on the need of upskilling and reskilling for digital and green transition, there I would like to say that there is a need of a new social right, and this new social right for lifelong learning means that it is an obligation for the state to offer this lifelong learning, and it is an obligation for the people, for everyone, to participate in lifelong learning. Otherwise, cannot participate in the changes of the labor market. And the third issue, and I have one moment, it is the old age. Demographic change places growing pressure on pension systems and long-term age. I'm not talking about the pension system, which is a whole analysis itself, but just keep in mind that in Greece, which is a small country, there are 300,000 people with dementia. This is the case in Europe. There are 50 million people with dementia. And the majority of member states have not public systems for long-term care. This is, again, one priority. Without long-term care, we cannot proceed. My last point is about financing. Do you want it to discuss then with the questions and actions? I think yes. Okay, because after saying what we have to do, then we have to speak how we will finance all this.
If you want to take a minute to talk about that, would be great.
Okay, yeah. Okay. But if you want, I can. We can do it then with the questions.
Give us a hint.
Okay. Okay.
Where is the money?
Where is the money? Okay. So the discussion focuses on each kind of financial and fiscal policy. So it has to do with taxation, wealth income and capital income has grown faster than labor income. So the taxation system has to take it into account and adapt accordingly. The second issue is that there is a need of stronger European coordination of minimum effective tax rates on capital. Just think of it. There is a country which is Greece, and then it is Bulgaria. They have common borders, and the differences in the tax rate of capital are huge. How can it work? So there is a need of European coordination. It's one of the most difficult and not accepted issues in many countries. Then it is the decisive action against tax evasion and tax havens. You can see an analysis how many hundreds of billions Europe loses every year because of tax evasion. The failed taxation of multinational and digital companies, now with the United States, it's a big issue. And the introduction of a golden rule to protect social investment with fiscal frameworks. Again, we have now a golden rule for defense. We understand how important it is for defense policy. But can we imagine what is going to happen in Europe if this situation with this political turbulence continues without taking into account the social policies? And of course, there are many discussions about AI impact. And you know that there are novel ideas about to tax the tokens, to tax AI intelligence units, because AI participates now more and more in the GDP in all countries, so it has to be taxed in a different way. And of course, we can see the good things, the what AI can offer to the to social systems, because AI facilitates very much the use of data, and this supports the prediction and better policies. And what is already in place in Spain, AI supports governments to match in a better way the economic situation of a person and the need for help. So a better way to disseminate the benefits. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, Panu, you also have the hands-on experience on dealing with the financing of social security, so I think it follows up very well. The floor is yours.
Okay. First of all, I would like to thank the organizers for the invitation. Incidentally, I must say, okay, there's a vested interest there because I'm closely associated with the Hellenic Institute. However, I have the feeling that we learn a lot from the activities of Hellenic Institute over all these years, and I wish that this will continue in the future as well. I'm also very happy that I met after many years Julian, that when I started my career in Bristol some centuries ago, he was already an established professor there, and I was really glad to see him here tonight. And I'm also glad to see that in the audience there are several friends, colleagues, and former students of mine as well. Julian and Anne presented the big picture. Now I'm going to the mundane of Greek policymaking. I decided to talk about social protection in Greece with this thing, past, present, future. Therefore, I will have a timeline there. I'll say what happened essentially before the crisis, during the crisis, after the crisis, and what's the future. Before the crisis, let's go there. In 1990s, Greece was a typical case of what Maurizio Ferreira would have called the Mediterranean welfare state, even more than Italy, I would say. It was a case which was characterized by low social spending, a very large gray economy. The social protection system was fragmented. There was quite a lot of clientelism, and there was quite a lot of corruption as well. Then the family and the church were playing roles that normally in a welfare state are associated with the provisions by the government. The benefits that were provided by the welfare state, almost all of them, were non-means tested. They were either contributory or categorical kind of benefits. And then if we go to the labor market, there was very low female labor force participation, and there was very high unemployment even in the good times. Just before the crisis, 2 or 3 years before the crisis, after Greece had 12 years where the growth rate was 1.5 percentage point higher on average for 12 years than the old EU 15 member states, we had the fourth highest unemployment rate in the European Union, and we had the highest unemployment rate both for females and for youth. This is the typical case of a segmented labor market, as Manolis Galerianos, who is sitting in the audience there, would have made. Then at that time, inequality and poverty in Greece were either the highest or the second highest in the entire European Union. Since the mid-1990s, we had the process started where we had a sharp increase in the share of social spending in GDP. And in fact, just before the crisis, this share was not substantially different. It was just marginally below the European average. Unfortunately, let me show you the graph first of all. It is all the years up to 2024 here. What you can see is that in the early years when we are starting, we are talking about a difference that is almost, if I remember, it is 12 versus 17, it is 6 percentage point below. It is, in proportional terms, 50% more than what's happening in Greece. However, this is closing quite fast, actually. Unfortunately, quite a lot of this was deficit financed. Let me continue with this graph. I will refer to it later on. You see that during the crisis years, social spending in Greece was higher than the European average. In one particular year, Greece's social spending was the third highest in the European Union. However, this was not because of the development of the welfare state. It was a denominator effect. It was because there was a real crashing of GDP. In recent years, this reveals something, that it is an accusation that against the government in Greece that perhaps we overspent during the pandemic year, and still the peak that you can see there, it is actually 2020. And then we are hovering slightly below the European average. At any rate, the real drama, however, was a different one there. To a considerable extent, this increase in spending was deficit financed, and we paid for it dear later on. The other thing that is quite important and is characteristic of the so-called Mediterranean welfare state, it was in the structure of social spending. if we go to see what was happening in the mid, in the first decade of the current century in Greece and the European Union, what we can see is that the blue slice is higher in Greece than what it is in the rest of the European Union. The blue slice is pensions, and indeed pensions were something like 6% higher among all social spending in Greece than in the other countries. As a result, all the other categories that we have there were underrepresented, were below the European average. I should admit that during that time, there were several new policies that were introduced. None of them was kind of a radical change and so on. However, most of them were in the right direction. The big issue, however, was pensions. This was a slow burning fire. The Greek pension system was a distributive system, overly generous, with several provisions for early retirements and the like. It was fragmented. At the peak, there were more than 3,000 funds providing either main or auxiliary pension in Greece. Each fund has its own rules, producing enormous inequities across funds. And the most important thing, all of them were backed by state guarantees. We started having substantial deficits in our social security system, even at the time that the effects of demographic aging were not evident. It was in the picture that Julian showed you before. There was a failed attempt, it was the Yanitsis reform, to reform the system in 2001. It failed, and it has catastrophic consequences for several reasons. First of all, it was the case that the reform program was that until that time there were several reforms in Greece. It was largely abandoned, for one thing. And second, we started creating large deficits of the social security system. Of all the increase in public debt between in the first 10 years of this century, that is before the crisis, more than two-thirds are accounted by deficits on the social security system. The path was explosive. We knew it. The actuarial studies were there. We were doing nothing about it. Just to show you this graph here, the blue line is the projected share of social expenditure on pensions alone. On pensions alone, if given our demographics, given our labor market developments and so on, with the existing rules at that time, at the steady state, the spending was reaching 25% of GDP. Just to give you some sort of an idea, now it is a little more than half this percent, this share. Somebody can tell me, okay, there may be that the contributions were high, so no problem. Contributions were hovering just below 10% of GDP. So in the steady state, the pension system alone was expected to produce deficits of 15.5% per year. Countries collapse far before reaching this state. And exactly this is what happened in Greece. Now, comes 2010, we have the manifestation of the Greek crisis. The Greek crisis, in the minds of most people, is characterized as a public debt crisis. It is not. It is a typical case of a twin deficit crisis. Vasilis is telling me that I must speed up and I'm not even in the half of my presentation. It was a typical case that it is a budget and a current account kind of a crisis. What was there, we were provided loans and later debt haircut in exchange for fiscal adjustment and structural reform. This is a typical case of adjustment programs. The socioeconomic cost of adjustment was enormous. 26% decline in GDP. Disposable income, something that is not discussed, more than 40%. To be more precise, peak to bottom, it was 44%. These are staggering numbers by any account. Unemployment reached 28%. Poverty with a fixed line shot up. However, if we take in relative terms, unlike what is in the public discourse, inequality and poverty did not move that much. Okay. In the field of social protections, there were substantial cuts. However, these cuts were not as high as the cuts, as the declines in national income. And as a result, we had this effect that I showed you before, that social spending in Greece appeared as a share of GDP, appeared to be rising. But also there were several structural reforms there as well. The most important were of the reforms were in the field of pensions. All this fragmentation was given, went away. There's a single fund at the moment, EFCA, for those in this. There are common rules for all. There are explicit rules that we have a national pension that is provided by the budget and the contributory pension that is based on specific rules according to our contributions. There are two myths in Greece. The first is that pension cuts, where there are many, this is the slogan that is there, that the main pensions or the main victims of the crisis were the pensions. This is not true. Pensions were cut substantially, but their decline was substantially less than the average decline in income from other sources. As a result, during the crisis, the relative position of pensioners improved, and improved quite substantially.
Comparing with that. Comparing with the other.
The relative position, not the absolute position. Of course, everybody went down there. The second thing was that all these cuts that we had there in the pensions were horizontal. They were not horizontal. The top end of the pension distribution was a real massacre, but these are the people who had most of the privileges anyway. The bottom of the distribution was relatively well protected there. Regarding other social benefits, the big change that we had during the economic adjustment programs was that there was means testing for the first time that was introduced in Greece for several benefits. It was the first time that was introduced a benefit of last reform, minimum income guarantee. In the labor market, there were many reforms that were targeting, first of all, flexibility in the labor market, and secondly, increasing participation in the labor force, and also regarding skills upgrade. The result of these reforms are evident now, in the sense that, you know, unemployment is reaching levels that we haven't seen for many years before the crisis, and I have the feeling that we will continue declining precisely for this reason. Now, in the post-program period, surprisingly, reform did continue there. The main reform in the pension front was probably the creation of TECA, that basically takes part of the pension system that was distributed and becomes fully funded. As a result, is reducing the exposure of Social Security to this awful danger that Julian indicated in his presentation before, the demographic risk. The deficits are still high. However, according to the aging report of the European Commission, it tells us that if we stick to the rules, to the measures that we've already voted, we are in a path of sustainable developments. However, I say that there are several indications already of backtracking there. In the popular discourse in Greece, there is a say, oh yes, but this is because we are massacring the pensioners. This is not true. At the moment, the replacement rates in Greece, that is average pension divided to average wages, is the highest in the European Union. It does decline, but still remains far above the European average. In the labor market, there are several measures to increase the labor force participation of women, youth, pensioners, and disabled. These are four groups where Greece is substantially below the European average, and some of the measures have already had spectacular results. Greece, at long last, is not, again, unlike what is in the public discourse, at the bottom of inequality and poverty statistics and so on. We are in the bottom quarter. However, we are in the sixth place from the bottom, the other one in the eighth. When I was younger, I was used to see Greece only in the last or in the penultimate place. And finally, on the negative side, however, the structure of social spending has not improved. In fact, it has worsened. The difference that we have from the European average regarding spending on pensions is 11.5, to be more precise, percentage points. Vasily, this is my last slide. Should I present it or not?
In 25 seconds.
In 25 seconds, you can read it, and there is no reason to say it. When Vasily sent us this invitation, he was highlighting four risks for the future: fiscal, technological, demographic, climatic. Regarding fiscal, Greece still has the highest debt in the European Union. However, the policies that we are pursuing in recent years have a very successful effect. It is the fastest declining, and also with a very healthy way, fighting tax evasion. That was something that we were always discussing Greece. However, I'm generally optimistic. However, populism is always around the corner. And I can see it even now. I mean, as soon as we had, let's say, these primary surpluses, everybody is going there and saying, no, no, why should we reduce debt? There are several other useful policies. Give us more, give us more. This is the useful policy. Technological, again, Julian and Anna refer to this. Definitely we need to adapt our education and training systems. However, the main thing that I would like to discuss is demographics. Something that we must understand is that these few children that we are making in Greece, we must shift resources from other directions, especially pensions that they are expected to decline, in order to improve the productivity of this younger generation, to invest in preschool education, in training, in R&D, in infrastructures, whatever makes this generation productive. It is not only a question of money. Anna knows it very well from her tenure in the education ministry. It is structures as well. This famous evaluation. Greece, in all these international comparisons like PISA and so on, even though we are spending more than the demographically younger than us, Ireland, we are far below them. Therefore, it is not a question of resources. There are other things there as well. This is not sufficient. We cannot overtax the young generation. If we decide to do this, they will vote with their feet. They will migrate. We will be in the worst possible outcome. We will have invested in them, and they will leave the country. This, to some extent, has happened in recent years as well. Therefore, we must be very careful there as well. Demographic policies, Julian mentioned this thing. I do not know of a single country that went below the 2.1 point of fertility and return to a higher level. In fact, something that we are observing in all developed and developing countries are falling fertility rates. And not only this, something very good, we are living longer. Therefore, listening to what I mentioned before, we need to keep the rules. Vasilis now is very angry, therefore the only thing that I can say is that we'll need to have migration, a very hot issue. The experience of Greece with migration in the previous decade in 1990s was a very successful one. Now we have many more problems. Julian again mentioned all these things. And finally, regarding the climate change, that is a very big problem that we have, because the environment, we all know, is an international public good. Therefore, there is...
This is 25 seconds.
Okay, yes, yeah. Okay.
No,
as they say, the climate change problem doesn't exist, so let's leave that aside.
Yep. I overdid it. Yep.
Thank you, Pano. So, thank you to all the speakers. I had prepared these fantastic questions for the first discussion between us, but now I'm not going to ask my fantastic questions. I will pass the floor to the audience. Please indicate if you want to ask a question, and we will pass the mic. First question over there. Yes. And then we'll take one from here.
Thank you very much for that. As Mrs. Diamantopoulou knows, I often try to provoke by asking questions that are not quite conventional. So today is a very happy day, because yesterday Mr. Elon Musk exceeded $800 billion in net asset worth. He's the first person in the history of mankind that has $800 billion. So the question is whether we should be happy that there are some people making so much money, and whether we should be unhappy. Because one of the issues is whether we should tax more billionaires. Mr. Jeff Bezos' net asset worth is $240 billion. The market capitalization of Amazon is $2.4 trillion. In accordance with Mr. Bezos, he has created wealth for other people of $2 trillion. The problem of American pensioners is who, as we know, invest in the capital markets in order for them to have their pension, is the possible correction of the U.S. capital markets. Because if the capital markets correct, all the pension funds that have invested in the capital markets and the pensioners may not be able to fund their pensions.
Can we turn this into a very quick few word question?
And so the question is whether the interests of society are aligned with the interest of creators.
Upward.
Point here. The UK is kicking out, has kicked out non-DOMs. As a result, the revenues in the UK have gone down, not up.
Okay. Thank you. We'll take another question from here, and then I'll let the panel respond to both points.
Yeah, I'm Bernard Casey. I was glad that Anna Diamantopoulou did mention the very old, because if I look at all the demographic statistics, what impresses me the most is not only that we're having more aged persons, but we're having more very aged persons. And the situation of looking after them seems to me the most striking problem that we are facing and failing to address. And I've been looking at this since I was working at the OECD on this fiscal implications of aging back in the year 2000. I'm still talking about it. Where do the solutions lie to this? Do they lie in AI? And can we move to robotic care like in Japan? Or are we actually talking about immigration, which is the way many Western European countries have solved the problem until now? Thank you.
Okay, so is taxing the rich and, you know, helping or not helping, and also will the robots look after us adults? Okay, we can, yeah, you want, we will do another round, but yes, are there any burning questions? Okay, we'll take one from the front here. Okay.
Hello, and thank you. I'm Konstantinos Kouras, Data Protection Officer and Legal Counsel at Our Future Health, which is a UK-based health research company. Can you hear me well?
Yeah, very well.
Do you hear? No. Is it the echo? Yeah. Can you hear me now? Yeah. I have two quick questions for you. One is, how do you think the global socioeconomic environment and global competition currently will affect EU's social protection systems? And what kind of changes do you see there, or adjustments, or maybe a new socioeconomic model? And I'm thinking of the Draghi report, his recommendations, and all that. And the second question is about brain gain, because I think something that all of you mentioned was aging population and how important it is to divert that trend. What role you see brain gain plays there? And, you know, I think it's very relevant for all of us here, in terms, like, we've all moved to the UK recently. And other than raising wages, what role do you think the cultural environment, diversity, social justice, the wider environment plays in bringing Greeks who live abroad and work abroad back to Greece? Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Shall we take do the reverse of the panel? Would you like to pick up on some of the questions?
Yep. Right. I would like to. Am I heard? Okay. Yep. I'd like to reply to your question, which is a very difficult one, actually, I must say. Let's see what most European countries, and not only European countries, did in order to counter the problems that we're anticipating regarding pensions. There were four types of measures that they took in order to reverse the trend. One was to eliminate early retirement schemes. Several such schemes were the leftovers of the first and especially the second oil crisis. Nevertheless, still some schemes like them exist in European countries. The second was to reduce the replacement rates. The replacement rate is, let's say I'm giving €1 or £1 to my pension fund, and what do I anticipate, let's say, to take later on? The third was to link either explicitly or implicitly retirement age with life expectancy. life expectancy, to be more precise, at 65, most of them. I mean, the so-called conventional retirement age. Some countries went even further than that. They have made a pension break. If pension spending exceeds some particular level of the population, of GDP, there is automatic cut in the pensions. All of them tried also to either create or encourage fully funded schemes that will operate in parallel to the distributive systems that they had there. That is, nowadays, these schemes are substantially larger than they were, let's say, 20 or 30 years ago, because these schemes are not subject to the demographic risk. Of course, they have the market risk. However, if we see, let's say, the experience of countries that have mature, fully funded schemes, the returns are substantially larger than the returns of distributive systems, and especially distributive systems of aging societies like the European societies. Is migration of some help? I think it is. For a successful migration policy, we know very well that there are two prerequisites. One is that the skills of the migrant workers must be complementary to the skills of the local workers. This is something that happens almost everywhere. Therefore, from this point of view, we do not have a real problem. The real problem comes for the non-economic factor. Migrant population must be integrated in the society. In Greece, we had the experience of migration in the 1990s. Even though we didn't have any kind of a consistent policy or anything like that, it was a hugely successful migration. It helped our economy. All the studies that we have show this. And it seems that these people had the one characteristic. They wanted very much to integrate into the Greek society. I can see it with my students in the university. There are several of them. I can see it, let's say, when I take the list in order to have, let's say, the exam marks and this kind of stuff there. In the classroom...
Where did the migrants come from? Hmm? Where did they come from?
They were coming from Albania.
Albania.
At that time. About two-thirds of them. Hmm? About two-thirds were Albanian. Mm-hmm. It is true that the younger generation of migrants who come to Greece are culturally far more diverse than what is the Greek population there. And in some cases, we do not yet have the ghettos that we have seen in several other European capitals. However, we are not very far from this either. However, we will need migration sooner or later, and the more effort we have in order to integrate them, the better it is.
Anna, can I ask you to address the question perhaps about how the current economic environment and maybe, you know, the recommendations for the Draghi report will affect the provision of social policy in Europe, if I understood the question well?
Can I just give a very short answer to the questions? The first question, Mr. Praskevas, about taxation of the very rich people. I think that it's a very difficult answer. I'm not pretending that I cannot answer easily, but the main argument is that taxing heavily the rich hurts the growth. On the other side, if we do not tax heavily the rich people, step by step, we are going to what we see today, that the ultra-rich people govern the world. So it is not the politicians, it's not the people, it's not democracy, it's these very rich people who become more and more strong. I don't believe that it is on the benefit of people and democracy. The second issue about the very old people, I think that it is not only an issue of social cohesion, but it is very important for women. Middle-aged women leave their jobs, leave their houses, and these are the ones who take care of very old people. And this is the situation in the majority of member states. And what are the solutions for the time being? It is migrant women, many of them in the black market, with no skills, no training, and they leave their own families back. And there are a few countries who have public care, long-term care systems. So I think that we need policies on this issue because it becomes more and more difficult. And there isn't a need of combination of workers, of robots. This is the case in Japan, but in Denmark as well. And of a public sector who can combine the social, the NGOs, because many NGOs work on that, migration and public financing. And what about the Greeks and how they are going to go back? In my think tank, we have made two studies on this issue. And it is interesting to say that the first answer, it is not the wages. It is not the social protection system. It is meritocracy. So I think this is the main issue, and this is that this is the sector that the political system had failed as a whole. And my last point, if you allow me, because there are so many young people and they're students and or yeah, work in Great Britain. Populism is not just a political wave that we see now. There was always there. What Panos described about what happened in Greece. Did we know what our pension system would create in our economy? Yes, we knew it very well. When I was a commissioner, every year, because I was responsible for social systems, every year the EU, the DG services were presented to me the situation of each member state. So in 2000, they presented to me the situation of the Greek pension system. And the result was that if we continue this way, in 2010, we're going to have a bankruptcy. I went to the prime minister, I explained it to him. He told me, please give an interview and give everything to the public. I gave an interview, I gave everything to the public. Nothing happened. Then there was the reform. And there was not even one member of the parliament who supported the reform. And all syndicates and all mayors and the whole country was on the streets. And everybody knew what the indicators were telling us. And I have a memory of going to a city in Greece explaining why we have to go on with the reforms. And I left with people throwing stones to my car. So it is so difficult and it is so important to have young political people who believe to the need of the reforms and to be ready to fight for this. Because it is so easy to fight for populist ideas. It is so difficult to fight for real things which matter for the people's lives. Thank you.
Julian?
I think that's a hard to follow. eloquence of that kind. Just a word about American capital markets and indeed about redistribution more generally. I mean, I share the worries that you're expressing about the increasing concentration of wealth among the Musks and the Bezoses of this world. It is worth pointing out, though, that simply redistributing that wealth, desirable it would be for a whole range of reasons, but it won't resolve the problem that the demographic problem we've talked about before. I mean, even if we were to take the whole of Bezos's wealth, the whole of Musk's wealth, and give it to European pensioners, and they would then go along to the supermarket to spend their newfound wealth, and the supermarket shelves would be empty because there is not somebody, because there are not enough people producing to do that. Redistribution on its own is not sufficient to resolve this ultimate demographic problem. And we have to look elsewhere.
Okay, we're running out a bit of time. I'll take two questions, very, very quick questions, please, because we need to finish soon. So can we have a question for the gentleman, Adoni? Yeah. Will this gentleman here in the front row? Adoni, raise your hand, please. Thank you.
I have a very practical question. Coming back to Vasilis, where is the money? I think we can all agree that Europe needs a massive social protection agenda. We can also confirm that there is a funding gap for that. So my question is, to what extent market-based solutions created by the financial sector can support this process? I'm thinking about social bonds. I'm thinking about private public participations. And also a question to Panos, to what extent in countries that these instruments are not developed at all, a central bank can play a role in facilitating? Thank you.
So new financial instruments, shall we take a question from here?
Thank you, beginning skimmers. Professor Solegrand, you gave an interesting presentation about the importance and the need for the welfare state and the health service. You even went as far back as the Black Death, which was pre-capitalist, but I won't go that far back. So would you agree with me then that the real motive, incentive for the creation, say, in the UK and anywhere else, the welfare state and the NHS was really following the destruction of what happened during the Second World War, period of reconstruction? They needed the workforce, they needed a healthy workforce. So it's not so much the Labour Party, which I define is not the party of the working class. It never really was, but we don't have time to go into that. So that's why they were clearer of the capitalist class, say, than the Tories were. And that's why they created the welfare state, the NHS, and the nationalisation, because they needed a healthy workforce to work, to rebuild, to create the wealth for the capitalist class. So would you agree with that analysis? Thank you.
Thank you. And can I sneak in a question as well? There has been a discussion about sort of getting better policies, fine-tuning policies. I think Panos spoke more in the case of this or that. And then the presentation by Ms. Yamandopoulou was also in finding the right policies. But we started with Julian telling us that, you know, we will face a reset, a systemic change. You know, we will face a reset. We will move from capitalism to laborism, perhaps. So to what extent should we be looking at better parametric solutions, improvements, parametric improvements, or just, you know, pause and rethink completely what is the objective, following also from this question, what is the objective of social policy, to what extent we want it, and what type of social policy, how would it look in the day after, so to speak. So a big question, but you each have 1.5 minutes to respond to all the questions.
Well, I think the answer to some extent relates to the point you were making. And indeed, it was made, I think, by Panos, that the only way to resolve this demographic problem is probably, well, there are several ways to try to resolve it, but we have to raise the productivity of the labour force, whether providing them with good health services, providing them with education, and so on. And this is probably the only way that will act, in short of being able to raise the fertility rate. Then I think the only solutions are to try and increase productivity, probably through policies of health, of improving health, maybe occupational health, focusing on very much on occupational health rather than the health of the elderly, and to try and increase productivity through education and skills.
Very good. Anna, would you?
I am going to tell something which is totally personal approach. After having worked a lot on the demographic issue with studies, with conferences, participating in different places in the world, I believe that it's mainly a cultural issue. And it is interesting, the last years I have meetings as focus groups with young women discussing on the issue of having children. It is absolutely disappointing that more than half of them do not want to have children.
Do not want
to have children. Mm-hmm. So it is it is not because they are poor, or it is not because they have not support. It is, I think it is a cultural issue concerning the way that our societies are being developed. So we need, of course, we need everything you said. We need public health, we need education, we need housing, which is a very important problem. We need support for children. Everything is very important, but it is not only that. I think we have to find out the way to present the model. I mean, we have destroyed the model of family, of having a family. And look in Japan, 45% of women do not want to get married. It is absolutely terrifying. So it is the way that women perceive themselves in this new society. They perceive the way that they're obliged to change their lives. So it's a very complicated issue. It's not just an economic and social issue. I think it is more than that. It's cultural. So it's interesting to start developing these ideas as well.
It must be also 45% of men don't get married, or thereabout.
I mean, they do want to get married because their lives do not change very much.
Okay, so Pano, I will leave the...
Sorry, your name said you'd about private and public sector cooperation. I think this is the key. For social protection is private-public cooperation is the key. Not three, public, private, and social society organizations.
Pano, you may want to say about financial instruments.
Very, very quickly. I agree absolutely with Julian on the issue of productivity. This is my last slide. This is what I try to say. All the effort must be in this direction. I also fully agree with Anna to... we need to have some kind of cooperation of public and private sector, and something that we need is what you did under the Blair government here, and you're the protagonist. You were the brain drain, the brain behind all these actions to create internal markets in the public sector, to make it mimic the more productive private sector. Now, regarding the problem of demographic aging, it is common to all countries. However, the consequences of the problem to the social security system are not equally important. Some countries have done their homework early, and they are in a far better position to face this problem than some other countries. This is the reason that if you see, let's say, what in the debates that take into account between central bankers and so on, they discuss about demographic issues. However, the main thing that preoccupies them is climate change. Right. And on this issue, on demographics, there is something that we are not discussing, not only in Greece, but in any country that I know of, seriously, and this is the next big thing that is coming. Anna mentioned this before, it is long-term care. Several schemes have been tried so far. Immediately, I do not know whether there may be, let's say, best practices from one country to the other. But
Denmark has the best. But it's a small country.
Okay. We can discuss it later on over there. And finally, regarding demographics once again, I can understand that Europe is aging fast, but there are countries, and it's not Japan, that are in a far worse situation. The fertility rate of South Korea is below 0.8, 0.79. If we continue like this, South Korea may disappear from the map, not because of an attack from the north, but for purely biological reasons.
Okay, not very optimistic tone. let me make an announcement before you all join me in thanking the speakers. Our next event is not in London. It is taking place in Athens on the 27th of February. We're having our second of our LSE Athens lectures in collaboration with the University of Athens. in Athens. So if you happen to be in Athens, or if you have nothing better to do on a Friday evening here in London, you can join us on YouTube. But if you are in Athens, definitely come. There will be wine after our LSE Athens lecture. But also before that, the LSE Hellenic Society is organizing the traditional Hellenic conference, which is taking place this weekend, Saturday and Sunday, somewhere here in LSE. So you can find information on the LinkedIn page and the social media if you want to register. I did my duty. So on that note, thank you all for joining us, and please join me in thanking the speakers for this discussion.